the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II,
a state of war,
to the present day.
Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. My guest is John DelVecchio, a Vietnam veteran and the author of the highly acclaimed novel about that war titled The 13th Valley. We'll be discussing his wartime experiences, and we begin with his views on what might have been, if only.
There's so many people that want to say that the war was inevitable, the loss was inevitable, that it was a winless war. And it's an absolutely ridiculous theory. We were winning. We were so... When I first got there, and I got there late in the war, I was there in 70, 71. But even in 70 in Northern I Corps, when I got there, everyone always had their weapons with them. By late 1970, most of the American weapons... back on Camp Eagle, they were all locked up. You weren't allowed to carry a weapon because you were more apt to hurt yourself or hurt somebody else than you were to be hurt by an enemy. Traveling out to the fire bases, out to Birmingham and Bastogne along Highway 547, early on, you wouldn't. When I first got there, again, this is April, May, June, 1970. Going through July, August, you wouldn't drive out to there without a convoy. And by the time we got into early 1971, you would go out there alone in a Jeep. So this is the very northern part of the country. This is where the war was still going on, and it was that peaceful. It was still dangerous, the war... attacks continued to happen, but they were very, very controlled pretty much along the border out into the Ashaw Valley and those areas. If you look at what was going on within the population, you had the elections, the legislative elections of 1970, I believe that was in August 1970 in South Vietnam, were considered some of the... some of the best elections in the third world as far as how that all happened. The people where, if you look at South Vietnam in the mid-1950s, this is not really a country. This is much more the equivalent of city-states, what you had in Europe, let's say, in 1500. By the time you get to 1970, this is a cohesive country. That country had pulled together... a lot of it because of Tet of 68, a lot of it because of the Abrams policies to protect the population, essentially to ensure domestic tranquility. Once that happened, people began backing their own country, and that we turned around and gave it up partly because of things like Watergate, because of many of the people that were against the war and had gained far more political clout in this country than people that were still supported it. You get into 1971, 1972, we did not need to have a strong military force in Southeast Asia. What we needed was approximately 500 advisors. We needed some technical people. We did not need any infantry. We did not need any artillery. Indeed, we had pulled out a good portion of the troops by the middle of 1970. By the time you get to 1972, we're out completely. And, of course, you have the peace accords in 73. If you look at the budgets, and I think this is very indicative of what happened in Southeast Asia. If you look at the U.S. budget to South Vietnam, it hit a high in 1969. Our budget adjusted for inflation in 74, 75 was 1% of what that budget was in 1969. If you look at what the other side was doing, the Soviets and the Chinese, the highest budget they had had to the North was in 1971 in preparation for the Easter Offensive in 1972. The budget for 1974-75 was four times that on the communist side. So you had 400% against, essentially against 1%. We sent South Vietnam into an economic depression. You had South Vietnamese divisions like the 22nd Division, where they took one of the regiments completely offline and just had them farming to produce food for the other two regiments that were in the field. That's the story of the end of the war. The idea that the South Vietnamese weren't defending themselves, the more you research that, the more you find that, and again, a lot of this happened in the Abrams years. That military became one of the best in the world. The South Vietnamese consistently in, as you get 71, 72, 73, into 74, consistently were beating the North Vietnamese. You had the regional forces, the popular forces, taking on North Vietnamese regular forces, consistently beating them. And then they just ran out of money, and that basically made they had no more power. The attack in 75, and, you know, I'm sure you know this, something like 500 T-54, Soviet T-54 tanks, over 400 mobile artillery pieces, tens of thousands of trucks. The North Vietnamese built, coming down what was a Ho Chi Minh Trail and actually through the Ashwa Valley, pipelines for gasoline and petroleum, 12-inch pipeline going all the way down to approximately Song Bi for gasoline, and 4-inch pipeline for oil. This was a major military, conventional military operation that was not opposed because, not that it wasn't opposed. I mean, the South Vietnamese did everything they could to oppose it, but they couldn't oppose it with a matching force because we pulled out all of the economic ability for them to do that.
Well, let's talk about some of the myths that led up to this, because I think that that's one way to put it. Myths perpetrated by the media, myths perpetrated by various elements in the country, various interest groups, etc., none of which were soundly based on the history of the place. None of which took into consideration what had gone on in the early 50s and when the atrocities that were being committed by the North against their own people. I read in something you wrote that it would have been the equivalent of taking 100,000 of the top American academics and professors in this country and assassinating them?
Probably worse than that. Actually, on that piece that I was writing, I was referring to a paper. I believe the professor that wrote it was from the University of Missouri, Edwin Moise, I believe his name is, or Moses. Yeah, quite a while since I read it, so I apologize about not getting the name right. But he was trying to prove that the land purge and the landlord purges in North Vietnam in 1954-55 and going into 1956 really were not as bad as the American administrations were saying. The Nixon administration was saying that there had been about 50,000 North Vietnamese killed. And this particular professor reduced that down, showing he was extrapolating from some reports supposedly that he had and saying that, you know, it was a lot of hype. And in reality, it was only 5,000 people. And I was taking the 5,000 figure because the population of North Vietnam at that time was around 11 and 12 million. And I was taking that figure and saying, well, okay, if it was 5,000, That was the equivalent of between 100,000 and 125,000 people in America. And if our military, if our government went out and whether it be politicians or whether it be landlords or businessmen or academics, if they picked a class and assassinated, executed 100 or 125,000, wouldn't you call that a bloodbath? And that was my point, that it doesn't make any difference. If you want to reduce it down to the absolute minimum, it's still a tremendous bloodbath. It was probably much, much worse than that. The reality is it would probably be at least the equivalent of killing a million Americans today. And that was kind of washed under the table. There are people right now today, for political reasons, trying to say that the Cambodian Holocaust really wasn't so bad. Whoa, wait a minute. You know, we have all the Khmer Rouge kept pretty decent records in Phnom Penh, at least in that one area of who they killed. And there were hundreds of thousands, and they took pictures of all of them. They collected all the skulls in these huge piles. This is a small country. This is a country of 6 million people at the most. And you have a minimum of 100,000 killed in that one spot. We usually figure that the deaths to the Khmer Rouge after 1975 are between 1 and 2 million. How can a politician today, and of course they're doing this because they're looking at what's going on in Iraq and they're trying to set up a particular story, and you have to get rid of old facts to make your new story work.
We're talking this week with author John Delvecchio about the war in Vietnam, and we'll continue the conversation after these messages.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, in conversation this week with John Delvecchio, author of the trilogy about war in Southeast Asia, The 13th Valley, Carry Me Home, and For the Sake of All Living Things. John served in Vietnam and was later a war correspondent there. He believes the South Vietnamese were on the verge of winning that war, but a lack of political will in Washington undermined their efforts. That, he says, was largely due to the U.S. media.
Isn't it very interesting that people like Ho Chi Minh was considered, and in this country is still often considered, oh, this was kindly Uncle Ho, right?
Only a nationalist.
A nationalist, exactly. And if you look at the way he came to power, he essentially assassinated or had assassinated the leaders of all other nationalist movements. He also had a purge amongst the communists so he could come to power. So it was his clique that came to power amongst the communists. You know, he was the reality, if you, the more you read about him, the more you know about his life, you find he was a whoremonger. This was this rather despicable creature, should be in the history books along with Idi Amin, along with Pol Pot. And yet, for some reason, he had an outstanding press corps, press secretary that told his story as though he was a saint. At the same time, we vilified Noah Zinziam, who probably was the closest thing in Southeast Asia to a saint. Mark Moyer's book, Triumph Forsaken, paints a, you know, a very interesting and very disturbing picture of particularly four American journalists and Henry Cabot Lodge in that period of 1963 when Lodge became ambassador.
Mike has been on this program, in fact.
Oh, has he? Yes. You know, that's a very telling period, and it's also very telling what is what those particular journalists went on to write, and they were often considered probably the vanguard of journalism in Southeast Asia, and the reality is they've been covering up the story of what of their own complicity in the assassination of Noh Sin Ziem the entire time, you know. So there's a I think it's very interesting, and I want to go back, you know, just here just a little bit to Ambassador Lodge himself and John Kennedy. If you may recall, Lodge comes out of the 1960 election. He was Nixon's running mate at that time. And he comes out looking like he is going to be the main Republican opposition in 1964. Well, of course, Kennedy sends him to the other side of the world, to this little podunk country, basically exiling him and getting rid of his potential opposition. Mm-hmm. At the same time, he's also sending a Republican there on purpose because if something goes wrong, he wants to be able to blame it on a Republican. Lodge, and not his finest hour for sure, he reacts by basically saying that he doesn't want to, you know, he is going to make a name for himself. And when he lands in South Vietnam in, I believe it was August 28th, 1963, he ignores the military. He ignores the CIA. He walks past General Harkins, who was the head of the military assistance group. It wasn't MACV at that point, but it was MAG.
He even ignored specific orders from his superiors back in Washington.
And as you move forward, he ignores even what Kennedy is saying to him. And the complicity between Halberstam, Sheen, Malcolm Brown, Stanley Karnow, and Henry Cabot Lodge.
Later CNN correspondent, Peter Arnett.
And Peter Arnett. The complicity with them and what happened and ending up with the, you know, this being a turning point of what's happening there with the assassination of Noh Sin Ziem and the turmoil that follows for the next couple of years, which is really what caused Johnson to have to essentially bring in the first of the major ground troops. You know, just talking about myths and the way things work. We often are told that the reason why we did send in the ground troops is the Gulf of Tonkin incident, and was it true or wasn't it true? You know, whether it's true or not, it's really not important. There were at least 150 major incidents before that. The Gulf of Tonkin, like remembering the Maine or remember the Alamo or whatever the rallying cry. This became a rallying cry that Johnson used to sell the war. But there was tremendous other justifications for us going in.
We're talking this week with author John DelVecchio about his experiences in Vietnam and his post-war views. This is Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network.
Real. Hello. medical talk.
What his kid probably went through is the most traumatic thing in his entire life, and you're not ready a week later to go on Oprah and start answering questions about what happened.
Real political talk.
Come on now, you're being cute. You know that you can give tons of money to the 527s, and they can do things to support the candidate you want them to support.
Political talk.
They got this guy now for everything but impersonating a human being and being a fugitive from the Board of Health.
Political talk with Toad. The Radio America Network.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get
gentlemen,
out.
This is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest face.
We'll have the air conditioner and we'll all
be cheerful Harlem all parade.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. My guest this week is John Delvecchio, author of The 13th Valley, a novel about the Vietnam War. John is a veteran of that conflict and has also written novels about other aspects of U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia. He believes that some members of the U.S. media undermine the South Vietnamese by not recognizing or refusing to report important differences between the regimes in Hanoi and Saigon.
I think if you're looking at the early years, one of the very important things is the North Vietnamese declared war on the South in January of 1959. This is a war caused by the North Vietnamese and by the communists. It seems to be lost in many of the histories that we see. Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. But in the meantime, as we say, the American soldier is being portrayed, or at least is being seen, as a pothead, baby killer, rapist, etc., and this image gets reinforced more and more and more every month that the war went on.
Absolutely. I think the military today is still fighting that tendency for part of our society to paint the military in those terms. It's something that they, you know.
But in Vietnam, it was the worst of it.
Vietnam was the worst of it. There was a movie, Hearts and Minds, and I don't know if you remember the image, one of the images in that movie with GIs setting a village on fire, setting the thatch roofs.
A la Kelly.
A la Kelly. That was supposedly a real incident. The reality is they were burnt. They did indeed burn a village there. It had been an abandoned village. That was not. You know, that was not mentioned in the film. But, yes, there's a tremendous idea that Americans created all or participated in all these atrocities. And this is not to say that some Americans did not participate in the atrocities.
That's true.
Which is horrible. All right. I don't want to downplay that at all.
No, should one. But.
But, exactly. It is minuscule and it is not by policy. The North Vietnamese had a definite policy of terrorism, and terrorism can be. Use the same word. Use atrocities, use whatever terms you want. These are not military targets. Between 1960 and 1962, the North Vietnamese were assassinating, in 1960, about 100 South Vietnamese village leaders every month. By 1962, that was up to about 1,000 a month. The idea was to cut off the head of the, in communist terms, cut off the head of the serpent. If you can get rid of the leadership, you can control the people. This is what they were doing. This is what they did in 19. When they took over in 1975 in South Vietnam, in the first 90 days, they executed approximately 70,000 leaders, past leaders of South Vietnamese society, everything from police chiefs, village chiefs, all the way up to national leaders. Mm-hmm. This is by policy. This is gone on for the entire history of the communists in Southeast Asia. It's the way they came to power. These are thugs. These are gangs. I think we're seeing some very similar tactics and some very similar thought patterns and behavior patterns throughout the Middle East. You know, right now, I think we have a potential band of Islamofascist terrorists from North Africa all the way over to Indonesia. And not to be aware of what happened in the past and the ramifications of our own actions and the ramifications of the actions of the opposition sets us up for similar results today.
Let me ask you this. We know what the effects were in South Vietnam. It was taken over and the country was, quote, united under one communist government. But what about the longer-term consequences back here at home? We know how the veterans were greeted, great many of them, disgracefully, and what happened to them. But isn't it, in your view, the way they were portrayed so constantly a factor in the very things that people now, you know, say they were whining about?
Yes, yes. When I wrote The 13th Valley, I wrote The 13th Valley about the 101st Airborne Division and to set the record straight for the 101st, because truth is, at that time, I thought, well, I guess all these other things happened that were being said in the press, but that certainly didn't happen where I was. It certainly was not the story of what was going on with the 101st. After The 13th Valley was published, in the next year, I received about 6,000 letters. They kind of came in two waves. The first wave was almost all from veterans, all branches of the service, throughout the war, all the different divisions, early on to later. You know, the 13th Valley is concentrated in the August of 1970. It's one operation. Over and over again, people were saying, hey, you know what, that's the way we operated. That's were you talking about my unit? Were you with my unit? You know, is that who these guys were? It was the beginning, really, of my education of who was America in Southeast Asia. Who were we? You know, were we this story that I kept seeing in the press? And the truth is, when I was writing that, when I'm looking at that in the late 70s, well, I bought into, or I believed that the press was at least partially right. I just knew that they weren't right for what I knew, for the area that I knew best. I knew that they weren't right. I didn't realize that the media has a much larger credibility gap than does the government or the military. The military itself probably has the least credibility gap. It's just not. It's not the military way. The whole idea of duty and honor that permeates the military does not allow for that kind of credibility gap. Does that mean that some people aren't lying? That some people don't cover things up? Absolutely not. But it's not. It's not part of the military culture. It certainly is part of our media culture today. It certainly is part of our political culture today. It's not part of the military culture. It wasn't then.
Well, the media, and I mean a whole lot of them, if not all of them. I mean, everybody says, well, look what radio and television did, and the newspapers did. But the movies and Hollywood did as much or more to perpetuate these and create and perpetuate these myths than anybody.
Oh, wow.
I know. That's another whole program.
It is another whole program. As you know, it's one of the reasons why I'm just very recently getting involved with a group called Charlie Foxtrot Entertainment.
Tell us about that.
This is a group of veterans coming together. I'm the old guy. right, I'm the only one from Vietnam. One of the fellas is active duty. Served a couple of tours in Iraq. I have representatives from the Air Force, 1st Gulf War, Marine Corps, the Bosnia, Somalia. So we've got a pretty good spread here. And we've put together a company to do, full-length major motion pictures. We're working on our very first one right now. And Dale Dye, who you may recognize the name, Dale was the second unit director for Alexander. He was the main military advisor, probably on about 40 different films, including Forrest Gump, Saving Private Ryan, Platoon. If you think of a decent military movie, Dale's probably been involved in it over the years. Dale's going to direct this movie. He wrote the screenplay, or rewrote the screenplay from the screenplay that some of our managing members wrote. We're hoping to go into production to not particularly political. We're not trying to be political here, but we are trying to be accurate to the military story and show accurately what soldiers experience, how they experience it. We want to tell honest stories. We want to tell poignant stories. We want to tell heroic stories. One of the things we definitely want to do, and this is something that I think is lost in Hollywood, the reason why societies need heroic stories is those stories spur us on to be better than what we are, right? That's what we want to do. We want to inspire people. We have been inspired by heroic actions, by heroes. We want to tell those stories. We want to inspire others. We want to bring out the best in people. You know, that's our idea here. And we know that the military and the best of the military is certainly the best to do this.
We've been talking this week with Vietnam veteran and author John Delvecchio. That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles, produced by Tim Holbert for the American Veterans Center and Kenny Burns for Radio America in association with Pelcom Communications. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
A special thanks to you veterans for your service to our country.
The latest official report from Washington said that warships had broken off the action and retreated.
From the Radio America Network.